Thank you. I'm surprisingly nervous tonight. I mean, I'm an attorney by training, and I've certainly spoken plenty of times, but here we are. So I am Leslie. I'm an alcoholic, and thank you all for being here. Tonight we're here to talk about the first step. I guess I'll qualify myself quickly, and I mean, how I make the cut here is my sobriety date is February 23rd, 1981. That means my last drink was 38 years plus ago. I was 26 years old at the time when I came into the rooms, or I heard it in a more interesting and nice way, when I fell into the arms of AA. I was 26 years old. And that's, in the end, that's kind of how it was. It didn't feel like that much in the beginning, but there it was. I think it's also important to say in 1981, rehabs weren't as common. I did not go to a rehab. I got sober in AA. I got sober attending meetings, working the steps, talking to old timers, listening to old timers more than talking, because they kind of, in those days, they didn't want to hear you talk that much, and they didn't give a rip about your self-esteem. So, you know, some may remember, some may want to forget. But anyway, I guess on to the first step. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. In order to prepare, I went through some of my favorite go-to books. It's a fundamental, of course, you know, the admission of powerlessness and the self-honesty to finally come to terms with the fact that my life was unmanageable, that our lives are unmanageable. I started with the book, The AA Way of Life, also known as Bill Sees It, and that has been one of my favorite go-to books from forever. And if you're not familiar with that book, what it is it's a collection of Bill Wilson's writings and chunks of the big book. But I wanted to start with self-deception. And in the 12 and 12, and maybe for you, but definitely for me, I always had to lie to myself in order to pick up a drink. I had to tell myself this crap story that it was going to be okay this time. And it never was, but I always said that to myself. So out of the Grapevine from 1961, there is a passage that says, "The deception of others is nearly always rooted in the deception of ourselves." So imagine how I feel reading this stuff. Like, are they walking around inside of my head? I always had a lie to myself that it was okay. In the big book, it talks about the phenomenon of craving. I didn't know that before. What I knew through repetition was once I picked up the first drink, I didn't know where it was going to end. The big book talks about the physical craving, the mental obsession and the physical craving, but once I pick up a first drink, it's all over. And there may be a little delay between the first and the second, but there's always the next one, and the one after that, and the one after that. I can't help myself. I'm an alcoholic. That's how it is. That's how it is for me. That's how God built me. Now, to take a first step, I had to lose my reservations, and you know, the book talks about that. In the big book, and I'm going straight from the excerpt taken out of As Bill Sees It. This is from Alcoholics Anonymous, page 33. The big book, and also the second part is AA Comes of Age. But the first part is, if we are planning to stop drinking, there must be no reservation of any kind, nor any lurking notion that someday we'll be immune to alcohol. and see that was part of that lie I tell myself. You see, next time it's going to be different. That idea had to get smashed. And the next part is, such is the paradox of AA regeneration. Strength arising out of complete defeat and weakness, the loss of one's old life as a condition of finding a new one. I was afraid to give up my old life, I guess, in some sense. You know, I made it into the rooms, but that's a beginning, you know. To work a program asks a lot of us. I really think it's about the bravest thing any of us or many people, like, setting foot around the earth have ever done. You know, we are the badasses, truly, because many people hide their stuff under all kind of stuff, and we don't have that choice anymore. When I was new, in addition to being young and a girl, which was kind of weird then, I had finished college. I'd managed to finish college. So, of course, I was very smart. And, of course, I used that to distinguish myself from some of the other alcoholics in my life. My relatives, you know, all those men who worked in plants in Pittsburgh, they were drunks, but I was smarter than them, so I couldn't be like that. You know, this the crazy stuff that we tell ourselves. What I was told and what I found out and what I've had the opportunity to observe many, 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 many times is that we cannot be too dumb to get recovery, but we can be too smart. I see Kevin nodding along with me, but that's a fact. I'm going to go back to the 12 and 12 out of as Bill sees it, and from page 29 and 30. And so what the 12 and 12 says is that to the intellectually self-sufficient man or woman, many AAs can say, yes, we were like you, far too smart for our own good. We love to have people call us precocious. We used our education to blow ourselves up into prideful balloons, though we were careful to hide this from others. I mean, again, it's like, were they following me around? You know, these people who wrote this book years before I was born. It's really, you know, kind of creepy. In its way. What my first sponsor taught me, she was a smart woman too, and what she told me and cautioned me about, and what I would share with you as a caution for yourself or for people that you may be sponsoring, is that for the person who thinks they're real smart, she told me I could have went through the 12 steps in about 6 months as an intellectual exercise because I had the ability to read a book and to follow instructions, but it might not have done me any good because ideally the way work in the steps really works and the way taking the first step really works is it is a felt experience. It's not something I read in a book. It's something that I get at some point in my guts, in my bones. It has to go to the heart, to the guts, to the spirit, to all of it, not just the brain. The brain's just a bare beginning, or at least it was in my case. I was taken to mission meetings, things like that, and was patiently told that you are no different and no better than these guys. God was just a little kinder to you and how your addiction went, how your alcoholism treated you. And so that was part of, you know, the education of Leslie. So there was also this. This is from the 12 and 12 also. The answer in the mirror. While drinking, we were certain that our intelligence, backed by willpower, could rightly control our inner lives and guarantee us success in the world around us. This brave philosophy, wherein each man played God, sounded good in the speaking, but it still had to meet the acid test. How well did it actually work? One look in the mirror was answer enough. And in fact, it was for me. That was a test I couldn't pass. I couldn't look at myself. You know, I knew I was full of it. I did. I knew I was full of it. You know, I knew I was lying to myself. I knew what I was. I couldn't pretend to be anything different. And as far as the fight, you know, people used to say that a lot in the rooms, and so I share that with you. You know, I was told to go take a look in the mirror and ask yourself, young lady, who's the boss? You or the booze? And if I'm honest, it was the booze, you know? It was the booze. It was not me. And so, you know, thankfully, those dear old timers, they had that going on. So as much as I wanted to argue, I was given a big book and told to read it, and told to read it daily or more than daily, and to talk about it and go to meetings and talk about it. But this was something that also made a lot of sense to me and helped me. And this is also from the big book. And I think it's a first step thing, because faced with alcoholic destruction, we became open-minded on spiritual matters. In this respect, alcohol was a great persuader. It finally beat us into a state of reasonableness. And that was when I had to come into the rooms, because I couldn't take it anymore. There was nothing real dramatic. I don't have a story of being arrested or being tossed into prison or having a horrible car crash or any of that stuff. I had never been married. I had no kids. I was a college graduate, don't you know. I did lose a job. I did. It was a nice job that I still think about every so often. But, you know, there it was, you know. I had lost that job, hit a bottom, started to come back and find myself. See, because I was going to a counselor, and I was so smart, you know, and I would go to a counselor, and what does any good alcoholic do with a counselor? What's the answer? Lie. Right, we all lie. Of course we do. Of course we do. And what happens when we come into the rooms and we lie? Somebody laughs in our faces and says, "You're full of crap. Get honest." And I needed that. I needed that. That was part of me really getting a grip on my alcoholism, the disease of alcoholism, the fact that I had it, the fact that I was no different, no worse, no better, no nothing than every other alcoholic walking around who can't stop after the first one. So, as Bill sees it, we kind of went through that. And the next book that was so helpful to me in kind of taking in a first step was one of my favorites, Living Sober. I know people listening on recording can't see it, but people in the room here with me can. And this book was another lifesaver. This isn't my original. My original I left at home, and it's all highlighted and notes in the margin, and I lived off of that book. But what it talks about, what I thought for first step material and something I know that struck me, was to remember, to really take in. See, there is a purpose for the brains, and that's to take in information and process it correctly and make good use of it as well, not to lie to myself and tell myself how I don't belong here. But remembering that alcoholism is incurable, progressive, and fatal. It is a fatal disease. People die of alcoholism. I'm guessing we all know of someone who died directly or indirectly of it. And I firmly believe, I was told this and I believe it, that if any time I pick up a drink, I'm playing with my life. I am playing with my life, and that is not over-dramatizing it. And I don't know how we went from you're playing with your life to relapse as a part of recovery, but I'll let someone else figure that out. I was taught that I play with my life every time I pick up a drink because this disease will kill me if I don't do some simple things. Anyway, what we see, according to this book, what we begin to learn is that in the long or short haul, our problem inevitably got worse. Some physicians tell us there's no doubt that it steadily grows worse as we get older. It cannot be cured, and that's from living sober. We cannot change our body chemistry and go back to being normal, moderate social drinkers, if any of us ever were. I know I really wasn't, but if you were, you can't go back to it. What the old timers in the room would tell me is, sweetheart, once you're a pickle, you never go back to being a cucumber. And there it is, you know, that wisdom of AA. And I want to just literally read this to you. But we saw we could, if we just kept on drinking, that is, get worse. If you get on a bus bound for a town 1,000 miles away, that's where you'll end up unless you get off or move in another direction. Okay, so what do you do if you learn you have an incurable, progressive, and fatal disease, whether it's alcoholism or some other disease, such as a heart condition or cancer? Many people just deny it's true, ignore the condition, accept no treatment for it, suffer and die. But there is another way. We can accept the diagnosis. You can find out what can be done. You can still live many happy, productive years as long as you take proper care of yourself. You recognize fully the seriousness of your condition, and you do the sensible things necessary to carry on a healthy life. We try to never lose sight of the unchangeable fact of our alcoholism, and we learn not to brood or feel sorry for ourselves or talk about it all the time. See, that was like a boom, 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 boom in my head. You know, just, yeah, that's where I was, but a look around, I see where I could be. You know, some people say you can get off the train at any of the stations, you can get off the elevator, you don't need to ride the elevator all the way to the bottom. And it's true. I live better if I accept the fact that I'm an alcoholic and take the direction. But it started to catch in my brain through going to meetings and meeting people and talking to people. There is another analogy. So, wouldn't you rather recognize you have a health condition which can be successfully treated than spend a lot of time miserably worrying about what's wrong with you? I finally came to that brilliant conclusion, you know, thanks to people who insisted I listen and read. We have found this is a better looking and better feeling picture of ourselves than the old gloomy selves that we used to see. And I myself was also offered the 90-day trial period, you know, go to meetings for 90 days, do what you're told, do everything that's suggested, and if you're not any better, then we'll give you your misery back and see you later. I was also, when I would have these episodes of, oh, let's say willfulness or self-pity or whatever it is that new people have, and some old people, I mean, I don't know if people still do this anymore, but, you know, people threw money down in front of me and say, go have the first one on me and come back when you're ready. So it's, to me, I think it's an important idea to me. I needed that slap in the face that, hey, sister, you know, you want our help, then accept our help and get with the program and do what we do. You can live better. If you don't want it, I'll spend my time with someone who does. I needed that. I do still believe that our program is for people who want it, not for people who need it. you need to buy in. You know, we can help people in all kind of ways. The only thing we cannot provide is the desire and the motivation that has to come from you. And that's what, you know, the first step is 100% on each person. It's not necessarily spiritual, but it's on you. It's got to be without reservation, to my mind, and it's got to be, you know, drop the debate. Just drop the debate. And one last word, because this was real, because I tended to feel sorry for myself because I was so young and I didn't get to do all this stuff and you know. So even when sober, this is eliminating self-pity from the subchapter. Even when sober, many of us remain clever at hiding from ourselves the fact that we are in a mess of self-pity. We do not like it at all being told that it shows, and we are quick to argue that we are experiencing some other emotion, not that loathsome poor me-ism. But self-pity is an enticing swamp, don't I know it, and it is also sinking into it takes so much less effort than hope, faith, or just plain moving. One form of self-pity when we first get sober is, poor me, why can't I drink like everybody else? I had that, and I'll venture to guess most of us had, but I'll speak for myself, I certainly had. And why does this have to happen to me? Why do I have to be an alcoholic? What this book tells us is such thinking is a great ticket to the bar room. That's about it. Crying over that unanswerable question is like weeping because we were born in this era and not in another, or on this planet rather than in some other galaxy. So it's just, you know, of all the things that, you know, people talk about, one of the things that I've come to believe is among the most useless things ever is to wonder, why am I an alcoholic? Who cares? You know, was the conclusion. What a useless, we'll keep it respectable because we're recording, but, you know, way to play with our minds to no apparent purpose. Because what does it benefit me to know why I became an alcoholic if I'm still drunk? It doesn't. It's never helped me to stay sober. You know, once I've learned how to not take the first drink day after day, you know, delving into some other emotional problems and stuff, but for me, in order to stay sober, it didn't matter a bit why I'm an alcoholic. To me, it's just totally useless. So, I guess I just take it on faith. So I did want to mention another book I didn't bring with me, and it was The Steps We Took, the Joe McHugh book. Many people use that. Many people like that. And what Joe McHugh says that the task of the first step is to name the problem and admit defeat. He is the one who says, where I got the phrasing, that's the 100% step, the one that's 100% us, not necessarily spiritual. But only we can come to that acceptance. I needed to give up the debate. I needed to give it up. I needed to stop the fight. What the old timers would tell me about that was, aside from looking at myself in the mirror, they would say, do you not understand, smart kid, that every time you take on booze, you get your ass kicked? You know, how many times are you going to get into the ring with Muhammad Ali? Are you stupid? You know, and it's true. You know, see, the thing was, the logic was flawless because it was totally true. Every time I drank, it was a disaster, and yet there it was. So I guess I didn't need to do much except start to give up the fight. Just, you know, but to accept that powerlessness, that was some of the things that helped me through it. And the, you know, surrender, I wrote this down. Surrender is about facing the truth, beginning recovery, and taking action based on that truth. Surrender is about facing the truth, and beginning recovery is about taking action based on that truth. That's what it's about. All that other, you know, mind blank stuff is just stuff. It's about action and acceptance. I do want to mention this. There's some young women here, but whoever is hearing this recording, I don't know. But this was important to me to know when I was very new and trying to not take a drink, not take the first one. Like I said, I was 26 years old, which meant I was still in my childbearing years, which what that really means is I still had periods. And I am here to tell you that early recovery and PMS do not mix very well. And a lot of the guys aren't going to tell you this because they don't know this. You need, a woman needs to stand up and tell you, young childbearing age ladies, before you pick up a drink or kill somebody, check your calendar. That has saved my ass multiple times in my first year of sobriety. Just it's like, oh my God, oh yeah, that's why, no wonder, you know. And it's true. I don't know who else tells you that, but I want to tell you that. So always be aware of that. I don't know what syndrome affects the guys, and one of them will have to tell the other new guys about it. But I can tell you for myself that PMS thing. Ooh, I'm kind of running. Anyway, okay. Well, part of me really getting a grip on the first step was to identify. And I am not exaggerating when I tell you, when I came into the rooms, there was not a lot of people under 30 and there was not a lot of women. So I tried to listen and identify where possible. But to me, it was very important to find a story in the big book that rang true with me. And I would tell that to anybody, and I still do. You know, read the book. One of those personal stories is going to be you talking back to you, just like one of them was me talking back to me. And in my case, the story was freedom from bondage. Okay, so, and I would read this story daily, and I'd cry my eyes out, and then I'd read it again and cry some more, and I'd read it again, and I would just do this because I got this woman. Because she was me, and I want to, it's in page 544 of the big book, but where she talks about, she says, at 23, I was just as sick as I was at 33 when I came into AA, but at that time, I apparently had no place to go because I had no drinking problem. Had I been able to explain to a psychiatrist the feelings of futility, loneliness, and lack of purpose that had come from my deep sense of personal failure at this second divorce, I seriously doubt that the good doctor could have convinced me that my basic problem was a spiritual hunger. And I will say another one of my beliefs is that, you know, I drank to fill that hole in my soul. You know, there's a hole in my gut with the wind blowing through it. I filled it with alcohol. So the lady goes on in bits and snatches, and this, I'm focusing on the first step stuff. I was immersed in self-pity and resentment. It became more and more necessary to escape from myself, for my remorse and shame and humiliation when I was sober was almost unbearable. The only way existence was possible was through rationalizing every sober moment and drinking myself into complete oblivion as often as I could. And that was me. That was me. What I thought of myself and in my fantasy brain and what I was doing was two different things. She goes on, the only reality I was able to face had been forced upon me by its very repetition. I had to drink. And so did I. I had to drink. I had to drink. This lady was hitting me right in the face. And then she went on, her last word was the unmanageability. I had certainly agreed, I had no problem admitting I was powerless over alcohol, and I certainly agreed that my life had become unmanageable. I had only to reflect on the contrast between the plans I had made so many years ago for my life with what really happened to know that I couldn't manage my life drunk or sober. And so that was what I read. That's how they got me, and that was kind of the beginning. I think I may end up, I love this story, and I may circle back to it periodically as this lady goes through different aspects of her recovery. But that's it. I think I've talked a long time, and maybe I've talked myself into only a few questions, so thank you.
Thanks, Leslie. So, does anybody have any questions for our speaker?
We can depend on Paige, you know?
She's a plant.
Leslie, what do you think, how do you process it when somebody that has a lot of time and apparently is working a good program picks up?
Scares the life out of me, scares the shit out of me. I do believe that, you know, that disease is always out there and it's waiting for me. I don't know, but it's scary to me. I'm grateful that it's not me, and I can only pray for them, because, you know, I've seen people go out and they're never the same again. They're never the same, a lot of times. If they make it back at all, then it's not easy for them, and it's terrible. I do believe that, you know, whatever any of us go through, it's not in vain. But the fact is, you know, we step over bodies. Any of us who survive and recover, we're stepping over bodies. And to me, I mean, I have to embrace recovery and do what I can do. I don't know what went wrong. I guess we only know what's between them and God. But I also believe that, you know, I guess this is next week's topic a little bit, but, you know, the thing that we can do things, but in the end, there's me, the drink, and there's God. And if I don't have a God, I could be gone. So I don't know, except it's the saddest thing, and, you know, reinforces to me that this disease will kill me. It's waiting for me, and I've got to be ever... You know, we have a daily reprieve. Thanks. Any other plants out there? Kevin, you're falling down on the job here with your plants.
Paul Alcoholic. Thanks, Leslie. My question, when you were talking about the unmanageability or quoting that, you know, I related to that a lot, in the sense that I remember when I first came in, my mindset was, yeah, you know, I can admit I'm powerless, but I'm just tired of managing my life because I have to do it hard. You know, it's hard, but I get it done. And it took me a while to get to that point where it's like, okay, I get it. My life truly was unmanageable. Can you talk a little bit about your experience with unmanageability and how you came to realize, yeah, my life is unmanageable?
Well, I started looking at, you know, what I had hoped to do and what I had actually done. I did lose a job that I really wanted, and I straight up drank my way out of that. And when I tried to stop drinking, I mean, I was unemployable kind of for a period. I could work, but I wasn't really. It took a while to get another job in my college trained capacity. That was a clear indicator to me. I actually, you know, this is only in hindsight, but during this little period at the end of my drinking, I actually tried to get an electrician's apprenticeship, believe it or not. seriously, because I did, because I thought, well, you know, whatever, because I, anyway. But I failed the manual dexterity test. And one of my little cherished beliefs was that I hadn't physically hurt myself, and it's only kind of started to come to me. Maybe I was kind of shaky, and that was why I couldn't flip them pegs in that pegboard, you know, because I couldn't do it, you know. I could do the math. I could do everything. I worked in a lab. I repaired machinery, fine little stuff. I drew blood from people. I mean, I had manual dexterity. I guess I started to drink my way out of that, too, and couldn't pass the electrician's test. So some of those things, you know, I mean, some of my bad choices, and you know what the lady talks about is the shame and the guilt and remorse. That was kind of, that was a lot of where it was at for me. So I hope that is helpful to you.
Hello.
You know, when I first came into the program, I really felt as if I, you know, the reason I couldn't stop was because I didn't have the willpower. So that's what I used to pray for, willpower. Did you have that too? Did you think it was willpower over?
You know, I really don't know. I know during my period between losing my job and coming into the rooms and seeing the shrink and lying to her, I tried to not drink, but I never could. I don't know if I had that conscious thought, but you know, I remember trying to lay off for 2 weeks, and I made it for three of the most miserable days of my life up to that point. So I don't know if that meant I had... I mean, I could lose weight. I could do all that stuff, you know. I could discipline myself to go running and this type of junk, but I couldn't not drink. So by the time I came into the rooms also, I have to say I had a period of attending adult children of alcoholics meetings. And in there, I started to learn about alcoholism and the disease. And what I eventually learned was, oh, yes, indeed, I do actually have that. That was among the time of talking to the shrink. And, you know, there's a lot of time in that period that's kind of jumbled up because I was drunk. So, but, you know, but I will say every time I went to an adult child of alcoholics meeting, I got drunk because it stirred up my crap. And the only answer I had in those days was to drink on it. So I hope that's helpful to you. Thank you.
Anybody else?
Oh, of course you will. It's gonna be a trap door question too, isn't it?
No, first of all, I want to thank you for coming out, Leslie. I really appreciate it, yeah, as all of us do. When you're working with somebody, and, you know, yeah, I realize I'm new to your program, but I've been to rehab, and that in rehab, I've done the first three or four steps. They don't let us out until we're done with that. I'm ready to work your program. I think I'm on step 7 or 8. How do you deal with that?
Well, you know, if you want my own thought is, if you want my help, then this is the form my help comes in. And if you don't like my help, then you can find someone who's going to co-sign your stuff. But I don't think that I did steps with a sponsor. That's the way steps are done. That's what the book says. And so I to me, that's like a non-starter, and I don't have a problem with that. Really, it's literally, you know, it's just like I was told, like, you came to us for help, you know. We were doing fine without you, and maybe you ought to try doing what we suggest, because it's working. You know, you're the one who's asking for help. So Like I said, I didn't go to a rehab. I guess there's a place for them and they help some people. But when I was very new, rehabs were kind of fairly new as well. And I got sober in Pittsburgh, and Gateway in Beaver County was the thing then with Dr. Twersky, God bless him. But at that time, there were people coming out of Gateway who would say, well, you know, because I spent 28 days in Gateway, that's like I have 9 months of sobriety. And I think, what the hell, you know? And, ooh, did I say that one? Yes, I did. Good thing I censored myself, too. But they would say that. And I asked my sponsor, and she said, the only way you get 9 months is to go 9 months without taking a drink. So if that's what they tell them, then whatever. But just don't worry about it. But, and I do want to say too, you know, I went to 6 meetings a week. Then I got a reprieve because I worked a ridiculous job where it was ridiculous. Okay, so, and I want to say for those who can't get to meetings, I had a job where I worked Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday 3 to 11, and Friday and Saturday 11 to 7. And I got to 6 meetings a week, and my sponsor told me it was okay to stay home Sunday and sleep. And so, in a town of any size, then it's really always about, do I want it? You know, it's do you want it? If you want it, it's here. And that was what I found out. If I want it, it's here. People will help me if I ask. They will show me what they did, which was refreshing. So I hope that's helpful to you or answers your question. Can I sit down now? Oh.
I think we're okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Leslie.